Hello, this is Michael Ray. Welcome to the Redstone Science Fiction Story Podcast for Memorial at Copernicus, written by Gray Reinhart. Gray is retired from the U.S. Air Force, which he had a wide variety of jobs. His fiction has appeared in Tales of the Talisman and Zaheer, and he's written a variety of nonfiction books. He is a contributing editor for Bay and Books, and he works for NC State University. It's an outstanding story, and we think you'll enjoy it. The story will be read for you by Amanda Fitzwater. Let's give it a listen.
Memorial at Copernicus by Gray Reinhart. Machek stopped the skimmer a few meters from his holy place. Its light shone on the low wall around the Apollo 18 landing site. Machek knew the layout intimately. The lower half of the lunar module, the antique lunar rover, the nearby experiment packages, and the Holy of Holies, more important than the old Luna 2 site or Neil Armstrong's footprint, Deke Slayton's grave. It was August 10, 2024, the 50th anniversary of Slayton's death. 50 years since the Spartan astronaut with the funny name rescued Valery Ademskoy, Machek's grandfather, from bleeding and starving on the lunar surface. Thomas's voice crackled in Machek's speakers and stirred him from his contemplation. "How long do we have to stay here?" his son asked.
"Quit the whining," Machek said. "No one made you come."
Thomas's voice had the distinct tone of being forced from a sneering mouth.
"No, Papa, but you couldn't come by yourself." "I would if I had to."
"How, Papa? Mr. Roycroft won't sign out a skimmer for one person." It was true. Brian Roycroft had been quite adamant.
"Mac, I can't let you go out that far by yourself."
It was only 100 kilometers. A skimmer could get there and back by itself.
"What is the worry?" Machek had asked.
"My job is to worry.
No deal,"
Roycroft said.
"What if I take Thomas?"
"He passed his EVA certs?
Sure, that'd be okay."
"I'm not sure he will want to go." Roycroft had the final word.
"Anybody could go with you, it doesn't matter who. You're just not going solo, that's all."
So, Machek had brought Thomas. Machek sighed and said,
"I would have found a way to come, but I am grateful you are here with me."
Thomas said, "I just don't understand why you couldn't wait for the ceremony."
"It is not the same," said Machek.
His joints creaked as he stepped off the skimmer. Outside the skimmer's beams, under only the light of the earth, Machek could barely see his feet in the thin gray dust. He shivered involuntarily, though his ultralight skin suit kept him warm. At Copernicus crater, the sun would not rise for 3 more terrestrial days. The inexorable regularity of celestial mechanics would not allow a daylight ceremony on the actual anniversary, and no one else minded the wait. The sunrise would be brilliant, lighting the rim of Copernicus and reflecting off the Apollo Memorial, when Mayor Paul Fabian of Slayton Crater held the ceremony with the NASA administrator. Many of the 3,200 residents would ride out from the Slayton Crater base, once known to astronomers as Gay-Lussac A, and virtually everyone on the moon would watch on video. But that wasn't right for Machek.
"I'm going to look at the LVRS," Thomas said.
Machek looked northward. The lunar vibration recording system that Slayton and lunar module pilot Gerald Carr had set up was about 0.5 kilometer away, over a slight rise.
"Very well," Machek said, "but stay where you can see the skimmer lights."
Machek walked into the light from the skimmer. He stood next to the low wall to hold his vigil alone. He wished Thomas understood. He owed his life to Slayton as much as Machek did.
But accustomed to life here, with friends from every terrestrial continent, Thomas had lost all awe and wonder at where he was and the life he lived. Maciek glanced up at the partial earth. His stomach tightened and his eyes watered. Let the politicians have their pomp and circumstance. Let his son forget. He would have his private remembrance. He turned on his hand lantern. The gold foil on the base of the LM was brilliant against the backdrop of night. About 20 meters to the left, the long-distance rover sat idle. Midway between the two, the mound and simple marker that the Apollo 20 crew had erected looked as pristine as if Slayton had just been buried yesterday. Maciek resisted the urge to step over the low wall, to step into history. Dick Slayton drove off in the Lunar Rover on the 7th of August, 1974. Gerald Carr waited in the tiny lunar module cabin. Carr fretted about Deke's heart. Only recently reinstated to flight status, Slayton had used his NASA clout to bump Fred Hayes off the mission roster. Their flight was supposed to have been Apollo Soyuz in 1974, but the Soviets backed out early, intent on their own lunar launches after Apollo waned. The U.S. quickly recommissioned the once-cancelled Apollo missions, 18 through 20. The space race tightened. Then, disaster. Maciek imagined Slayton's long drive in the rover, north to the edge of Mare Imbrium, to the doomed Luna 25 expedition. He heard whispered voices, echoes of a half century ago, more static than signal. No, they were real voices. He turned the volume up on his suit radio. Must return to origins. Units that cannot return by 1745 local must shelter in place. Repeat, this is Slayton Central Control. A Class M solar flare is in progress. All surface units must return. The broadcast cycled through the instructions once more. Maciek looked at his chronometer. Plenty of time. Central is very protective. We are in no great danger on the night side, although the magnetosphere may funnel some particles our way. Thomas, are you on your way back? We must return. Maciek walked back to the skimmer. He called again, and still Thomas didn't answer. It made no sense. He must be receiving. As long as his suit had power, the radio should work. It had no off switch. Maciek called a third time. No response. Deke Slayton switched off the transmitter. Command module pilot Vance Brand had pinpointed the Luna 25 landing site. Houston reported all contact lost with the cosmonauts. They're in trouble, Slayton said. Gerald Carr nodded. Precious little we can do about it. Yeah, there is. I'm going to find them. They argued for a few minutes, but Slayton held firm against all objections. He acknowledged that the Soviets were probably dead already. He acknowledged the danger. He admitted he'd be taking the rover far beyond its even extended range, and his suit wasn't meant to sustain him that long. You remember Gene Cernan's script from 17, he said. We leave as we came, and God willing as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind. What does peace and hope mean if it doesn't mean trying to rescue a shipwrecked crew, no matter what flag they fly? If I was out there, I'd want someone looking for me. Maciek drove the skimmer to the LVRS site. The seismic detector looked brand new, even though it had quit detecting four decades ago. Maciek turned the skimmer in a slow circle, casting long, low shadows behind the rocks. There, a spot of high-visibility orange, 200 meters to the west, halfway up a small ridge. He called again on the radio. Papa? Even in line of sight, the boy's voice was barely audible. Maciek sped towards the spot. Thomas, what's wrong?
Rocks turned under me.
broke my high Ganyan tenor, I think. In the next few seconds, Maciek reached the bottom of the ridge. Broke my leg, too. Maciek parked the skimmer and sweated up the hill with what tools the vehicle carried. Thomas was lying on his back, his left leg twisted and lodged under a boulder that probably massed 1,000 kilograms. Maciek worked for 20 minutes to find the right purchase to prise away the rock. He moved the boulder a few centimeters, but while Thomas tried to pull out his foot, a cascade of smaller rocks turned the big one and trapped him again. Maciek thought about trying to prop up the boulder and dig around the boy, but refused to accept the risk of tearing Thomas's suit or further damaging his leg. Instead, he dug out some smaller stones on the side away from Thomas and tried to pry the boulder up again. This time the angle was wrong. It moved, but not enough. Slayton Central Control repeated the flare warning. Maciek dug and pried until sweat filmed his eyes, and he thought his muscles would snap. Finally, 2, 3, 5 centimeters of movement, and Thomas stoically dragged his foot out. No time to rest, no time to gather the tools. Maciek led the way down the hill. Thomas ground his teeth during their slow descent, but otherwise his radio broadcast only his breathing. He leaned on Maciek and hopped, one-legged, down to the skimmer. The boy cried out only when he twisted himself into the seat. Maciek's heart, near bursting with exertion, swelled even more with pride. Maciek noted the time. They would miss Central's deadline now, but he couldn't shelter in place. Thomas needed medical attention. They started on a slow ride back. Beside him, his son breathed raggedly. Maciek imagined his grandfather Valerie's labored breathing as Deke Slayton drove him back to Apollo 18. Gerald Carr contacted the rover as soon as he saw it. "About damn time, Deke. Houston's mad as hell. Get on in here and let's go home." Slayton's reply was drowned in static, but Carr heard one survivor. He used the zoom lens on their Hasselblad camera to verify that another spacesuited figure was riding next to Slayton. He loosed a series of epithets Nasser would never have approved. "Start prepping the LM for launch," Slayton said. "What do we do with the commie? Fold him up and stow him with the rocks?" "No, this guy's hurt. There's blood all over the inside of his faceplate." "He'll ride in my seat." Carr opened his checklist. "Deke, that's suicide," he said. The rover got closer and closer as he went through the first steps, and Carr was about to transmit again when Slayton replied. "No, it's not. There's a difference between suicide and sacrifice, but I don't plan on either one. I'll recharge my suit, rig a connection to the O2, and eat until I'm stuffed. If I ration my water, I should last long enough. If they can get 19 off the ground fast enough," Slayton paused, "or if the Ruskies can get Luna 26 on its way." "You know they can't do that, Deke." "Tell them to try," Slayton said. "They have to try." Maciek walked beside the gurney. Thomas showed the effects of the sedative. His face had relaxed. Now and then his head rolled from side to side. Maciek brooded. His wife would blame him for Thomas's injured leg. Central would censure him for their late arrival. Those 2 hours could cost him his license. "All because of my foolish devotion to the calendar." Maciek felt a hand on his. Thomas moved his lips, but no sound came out. Maciek bent close. He smiled when he heard his son's whisper. The boy understood at last. "Thanks," Thomas said. "Thanks, Deke."
We certainly hope you enjoyed this story podcast from Redstone Science Fiction. Excellent job by the author, Gray Reinhardt. and by the reader, Amanda Fitzwater, a science fiction writer and vocal artist from New Zealand. Thanks for listening to this story podcast from Redstone Science Fiction. We look forward to seeing you next time.